Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Glucksman Ireland House NYU Radio Hour. My name is Dr. Miriam Nighan, and I will be your host on Saturdays from 9 a.m. to 10 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. You can tune in to us on WNYE 91.5 FM and on HD in the Tri-State area, and worldwide on nyuirish.net/radiohour and at irishradio.com. So whether you're here in New York City or in Ireland or somewhere else further afield, sit back, relax, agus fáilteach. For those of you who don't already know, Glucksman Ireland House is NYU's Centre for Irish and Irish American Studies. Inspired by the vision and philanthropy of Lewis L. Glucksman and Loretta Brennan Glucksman, Glucksman Ireland House NYU has evolved into a vibrant and world-renowned centre for the study of Ireland, Irish America, and the global Irish since its founding in 1993. We're coming to you today from our home, which is an elegant townhouse at Washington Mews and Fifth Avenue in New York City's Greenwich Village. Well, today, folks, to the day, we are marking the 150th anniversary since the birth of the world-renowned Irish poet W.B. Yeats. Later in this program, I will share a discussion that Professor John Harrington of Fordham University recently gave here at Glucksman Ireland House as part of the celebration of the upcoming Yeats Summer School. And in this very interesting talk, Dr. Harrington discusses Yeats's interactions and visits with the United States. Given that our interest is a lot of the time on Irish America, I thought it would be a nice intersection for us to think of Yeats in the context of his visits to us here in the United States. So I'm delighted to be able to share that with you on this birthday of W.B. Yeats, as I've mentioned. First up in the program, I am delighted to also welcome to the Glucksman Ireland House NYU Radio Hour, actually for the first time being here in Washington Mews with us, Panty Bliss. That's Rory O'Neill, a.k.a. Panty Bliss, who is here in town at the moment as part of her run of shows at the Irish Arts Centre, the last of which will take place tonight. And the tickets are all gone, and it's a very popular run of shows. And it's great to have the opportunity to have a chat to Rory in the wake of the same-sex marriage referendum, which recently took place in Ireland and was passed with a resounding yes. And it's quite historic to have the opportunity to speak to an activist like Rory, who has played such a key role in that referendum over the last few months, and indeed in terms of his activism on gay rights in Ireland over time. So it is an honour to actually sit down and have a chat to him and share our thoughts on the Glucksman Ireland House NYU Radio Hour. Before I go any further, I do want to draw attention to the fact that Father Colum Campbell, who was a well-known person here in the New York area for a long period of time. Many of you know he was very involved in the New York Irish Center in Long Island City, and indeed was one of the people who really he was a founder of the New York Irish Center in Long Island City, and was president of the institution for a long time, and the spiritual leader for people who were involved in the Long Island Centre and for the Irish community more generally. He passed away in Belfast during the week, and I'd like to next week go into the archive and share with you Father Colum in his own words. He contributed to the Archives of Irish America Oral History Collection, and it's an honour to be able to share some of his reflections with you. So, Eriesh Deg Ravahanam Dilish. And we're thinking of the family and friends of Father Colum. He was a very popular figure. So I'm going to welcome Rory O'Neill now. I'm here at Glucksman Ireland House NYU, welcoming for the first time, I believe, Rory O'Neill, a.k.a. Panty Bliss, who is here in New York. The popularity of tickets and the interest in your run of shows over the last few nights at the Irish Arts Centre has been, I'd say people are begging, borrowing and stealing, trying to get tickets, and we're delighted that our friends at the Irish Arts Centre I suppose this was long planned before the referendum and everything like that.
Before the referendum and all that, yeah. I had come over here last year to talk at the Irish Arts Centre, tied in with the St. Pat's for All parade. So we've been talking to them ever since.
Yeah. So welcome to Luxembourg Ireland House, Rory, and it's a personal honour for me and an honour for us here at Luxembourg Ireland House NYU to speak to you. I suppose it's 3 weeks to the day since the referendum was carried, same-sex marriage referendum was carried. Are you still on a high from it all?
Kind of. I mean, it was a really incredible day, the results day. I mean, people had worked so hard and people also invested so much in it. But I think even we and everybody else were taken a little by surprise by, you know, on the day of the results, how much it had meant to everybody. I think maybe when you're in the campaign, you're just going, you don't really have time to think about it. And then on the day when the results started to come in, like from early on the day, I mean, people were just crying everywhere. And then all those spontaneous street parties just burst out all over the city. It was really an incredible and amazing day.
It seemed like especially in the last few weeks of the campaign and the in as much as you can read polls and everything, it looked very positive, but I suppose there was a fear that people would be relaxed and not come out in the numbers, and that was really effective.
The polls are always in our favour, but as we know from past referenda, especially on social issues, and of course it was also very much in our minds, we're looking across the water at Britain, all the polls suggested, you know, that Labour were going to get in, and then, so polls are a funny thing, and especially on an issue like that, because there was a feeling, or the narrative being put abroad was that there was this silent no vote. People who were afraid to say that they were going to vote no, who would then come out on the day and vote no in large numbers. Now, thankfully, that didn't happen. I was very nervous about it, and I think everybody was, and nobody was taking the polls that seriously. And it really wasn't until a day or two before I started to allow myself, you know, to think positively about it. I mean, I was afraid up till then to think positively about it. But it was actually the night before the result that, you know, late that evening after the polls had closed, I got a text from somebody who had been working at the Dunleary count, or the Dunleary polling. And there was already rumours going around that Dunleary was voting very high, yes. Now, traditionally, Dunleary has been the most liberal constituency in the country. So even taking that into account, though, I started the night before thinking, oh my God, I think we have this. And then everyone was taken back the next day by how early it became pretty clear we had it. I think we were all expecting it to be 3 or 4 p.m. before we could really call it. But by 10 a.m. it was essentially being called.
Rory, can we go back a little bit in terms of your own trajectory? I mean, I suppose to talk a little bit about your activism and involvement, which has culminated in this great success in the last few weeks. But you were born into a very different Ireland. I mean, you know, as someone who's a historian, it's just remarkable to think about the changes in Ireland in a very short period of time. I know it's probably too early and it's too close, like in time and just in terms of like intellectual space, but have you gotten to any sense of like how that change has come about so quickly?
Well, I think there's a few things at play here. I mean, if you consider that homosexuality was only decriminalized in 1993, so the journey from 1993 to full equality now, it's an incredible journey. And I think there's a number of things at play there. First of all, I think Ireland's size allows it to change more quickly. There's that. There's also, you know, once people start coming out, as they have been doing for the last 30 years, the situation in Ireland is that you'd be hard-pressed to find anybody who doesn't have a gay family member or neighbor or friend. And that's what changes the world, really. And I think it's more likely that you could be living in Texas and not know a single gay person. Whereas in Ireland, that's really not possible. Ireland is too small for that. And everybody has a gay cousin or, you know, lesbian sister or whatever. But then also, it's the power of the internet is so incredible. Or, the miniaturizing of the world via TV and all of that, but especially the internet. Because Ireland has been totally opened up to outside influences in a way that absolutely wasn't in the 1970s or even the 80s. I mean, I remember in the 1970s, my American aunt used to come, and one summer she brought us hoodies. You know, we'd never seen a jumper with a hood on it before. You know, we just thought it was the most amazing thing ever. And I certainly, even when I was in college, finding other gay people was this huge, you know, palaver. Whereas now, that simply isn't an issue. And so all of that stuff changes. And then when we started agitating first for civil partnership, that seemed like the way to go. We were going to, you know, civil partnership, and it was a slowly, slowly approach. And if you'd said to us 15 years ago, oh, we're going to have civil partnership soon, we would have thought that was incredible and amazing. And there was a long, you know, ground war campaign going on for civil partnership, being led by these sort of older or so well-established equality groups, people like Gay and Lesbian Equality Network and so on, who'd spent many years learning how to shake hands and talk to politicians and all of that. But in some ways, they were almost overtaken by these young, very spirited young groups who saw civil partnership as a kind of an insult. Mm-hmm. And they wanted to go straight for marriage equality. And they started to agitate for that. And the reason they were doing that is because they were utterly influenced by the internet. They were seeing, you know, the American campaigns here for marriage equality and other countries around the world. And they were watching the ads on their Facebook and, you know, and they were influenced by groups like ACT UP and that. So they were doing sort of direct action stuff. And there was a period a few years ago where there was a lot of tension in the gay community at home between the sort of more established older groups who wanted to go for civil partnership as a sort of stepping stone and these younger, very sort of, you know, noisy, enthusiastic groups who wanted to campaign immediately for civil marriage. And that's really the power of the internet that did that. You know, we were swept up in sort of the global tide.
Rory, you know, in the run-up to the referendum, I was teaching my boss, Jolie, has been on sabbatical this semester, and I had the honour of teaching his class while he was away. And we were on, you know, 20th and 21st century Irish history. And what was remarkable to me was that there was a lot of discourse on this topic right around the time of the referendum here because of various things that were going on here in terms of legislation and things like that. And for me, it was amazing that the same kind of conversations were occurring in New York City about legislation in this country at the same time as my parents are talking about it in Arklow County, Wicklow.
Yeah.
That the velocity and the pace of change has been so phenomenal. You know, when you think about things that we were always behind America or behind Britain in terms of certain social development.
But you can even see now that our referendum has put the pressure on other countries now. And again, that's the interconnectedness of everything. So it's really pushed the conversation on in Australia. It's pushed the conversation on in Germany because they have civil partnerships but don't have marriage equality. And now they feel embarrassed that little old Ireland, you know, whatever. And even in Italy, which is really the only developed country, certainly the only European country that has absolutely no form of partnership rights of any kind at all. And even, you know, their prime minister has sort of basically come out and said, well, if Ireland can do that, what are we doing?
One of the, I suppose, kind of related to that point in light of the referendum, and I suppose the referendum has been this watershed moment to really make us think as well. What it's made me think of as someone who's a migration historian is, you know, in decades gone by, if you were gay and you wanted to live openly, you had to leave. And they came to New York or they came to London and things like that. And now that aspect of forced migration because of one's sexual orientation or gender identity or whatever is no more. There's a change in Ireland.
Yeah, there absolutely is. Now, I think, you know, Ireland still has small town syndrome. Mm-hmm. So you'll still find gays who just feel like they can't really be gay in their tiny hometown in Leitrim or whatever. So they do. But in general, yeah, you're absolutely right. And actually, that's one of the things that really annoyed me about the economic collapse, because during the boom time, it really was the very first time ever where young people didn't immigrate. And they all stayed, and I could see it sort of out and about in town. You know, young people everywhere, and they were doing things and making things, and it was sort of great. And young gay people, for the first time ever, didn't leave. I mean, there was a time when young gay people left, and especially creative ones or ones who wanted to be involved in things. They all went to London or New York or wherever. And they were all staying for the first time. And that was sort of thrilling to me. And then, of course, you know, the recession came hard and they were all forced to emigrate for other reasons. You know, I have the bar at home. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's in the space of a year, half of our customers, all the younger ones, all up to sticks and left.
Can I ask you, Rory, because you spent quite a bit of time abroad when you were younger and everything, and you ended up going back to Ireland in a way because of circumstances right at the time. But has it been important for you to stay in Ireland? Do you love living in Ireland? I mean, in some ways, I feel like it might have been easier for you at certain points in time to have gone somewhere else, to come to New York or London or something.
Yes, it would have. And certainly when I was younger, I never, ever envisioned myself living in Ireland. You know, I got out of there in the, you know, the late 80s when, you know, Ireland was pretty grim, especially for, you know, a young gay person. Mm-hmm. So I ran out of there. And all I wanted to do was live in the biggest cities in the world, you know. And then, as it happened, I ended up in Tokyo for most of it. I went back because I was ill and I needed to sort of take some time out. But I thought, oh, well, once I've recuperated, I was still going. My plan was to go off somewhere else. But I went back in the mid-90s, and that was actually a really exciting time to be in Ireland. Everything was changing. And there was a sense of possibility about Ireland then that we'd never had before, and a sort of a self-confidence we'd never had before. It was actually a very exciting time, and I loved it then. I said, oh God, actually, Dublin is full of possibilities. And so for the first time ever, I felt like you could do world-class stuff in Dublin, which I'd never felt before. And also I felt that Dublin was, I'm saying Dublin just because that's, you know, my reference point, but I also sort of felt that Dublin was expanding to allow other kinds of Irishness. And that was very important to me and the people that I was working with. And a lot of the stuff that we did then was about expanding the definition of Irishness. Because I think before then, you know, in order to be fully considered Irish, even by other Irish people, you needed to be, you know, GAA playing, you know, pint drinking. You know, there was a very strict formula for Irishness, and other sort of expressions of your Irishness weren't considered authentic or something. And that was all changing. And thankfully, it's gotten to the point now where it's utterly changed, really, in so many ways. And, you know, nowadays you can be a flaming queen covered in glitter like I am and still be Irish.
That brings me kind of nicely to my next question, Rory. I'd like to get a sense of, I suppose, more so as Panty, do the Irish abroad interact with you differently to the Irish at home?
Perhaps a little, because I think the Irish abroad are seeing it through this sort of refracted prism. I think the Irish at home are half down their fed up with me. I'm kidding. But I think there's the Irish abroad sort of like to imbue the Irish things that have come over with a sort of a gravitas that the Irish at home don't bother with. So it's not that they interact differently with me, but also the kind of Irishness that I interact with abroad. So if I'm here and I'm in the Irish Arts Centre, you know, there's a certain kind of Irishness that is thrilled that the Irish Arts Centre has a big giant drag queen, because that seems, you know, out of the box a little for the Irish Arts Centre. And, you know, I know gay Irish people living here or whatever, they love that. And because it also feels, I think, to them, like the formula for Irishness, you know, has been loosened. And if, you know, Panty can be in the Irish Arts Centre the week after whatever, you know, Bowron gig, you know, that they enjoy that. And I find that all over. I was in Australia there a while ago, and it was the Irish consulate were involved in sponsoring that. And part of the deal was that I did the, they put an Irish float in the Mardi Gras parade for the first time in many, many years. And the Irish consulate, you know, sponsored that part of our tour, just that bit. But in the float, they basically, you know, a couple of months beforehand, they put a call out to say, right, we're going to have an Irish float in the Mardi Gras parade. Panty's going to be on it, and we need volunteers. And like 120 people volunteered, and they spent, you know, the month or 6 weeks or whatever beforehand meeting together regularly, building the float, rehearsing this dance routine that they do down the street in the middle of the parade, organizing the costumes, all of that stuff. And this 120 people all became sort of very good friends and worked together. And then they sort of redid a version of the float and put it into the St. Patrick's Day parade. But the consulate were absolutely thrilled, because normally the kind of Irish people that they connect with in Sydney or whatever, it's a very specific kind of Irish person. So, and in a way, this, the kind of people who volunteered for this, I mean, there was doctors and all sorts, but it was, you know, a lot of the queer community and their friends, and it was just a kind of Irishness that the consulate would never normally engage with the kind of things that the consulate is doing. So it connected them with a whole other kind of Irishness.
Yeah.
And I think that's a kind of Irishness that's much more reflective of what Ireland is like now.
So to that point, Rory, have you come across the type of Irishness, you know, I mean, and we think that this is just a product of Irishness, but as someone who's kind of spent her time looking at other diasporic groups as well, it's not just particular to the Irish, but there tends to be sometimes a lag between how the people in the homeland view their sense of nationality, in our case, Irishness, vis-a-vis then people outside of Ireland, you know, and there's a sense of authenticity of what Irishness should be. Have you encountered any resistance in terms of, because you're challenging assumptions of what Irishness is?
Well, I have to say, at home, no.
Yeah.
I mean, occasionally online or something, you know, the usual. I haven't really, you know, at all, really. Most people seem to. But then again, you know, if you are the kind of person who's going to think that way, you're not going to come to my show anyway.
True.
You know, but I think that's absolutely true, the lag, because the Irish abroad left at a certain point, and their image of Ireland is very much rooted at that particular point. And that's something that annoys us at home a lot, and it came to the fore a lot around the referendum. And one of the great things about referendum is the possibility that it might finally change that. You know, practically every headline will say things like, this conservative country, this super religious country, you know, this kind of stuff, which never feels like the country that I live in. That feels like a very 1950s view of Ireland, and yet every country has that still view about it. I partly blame Bord Fáilte, who are wonderful and all that, but they have played on that image for the last, you know, 30 years, to the exclusion of other images of Ireland, but although that's changing now too, thank God. But so there is this sort of calcified view of Ireland abroad. And that's why I think we created so many headlines around the world as a result of the referendum, because it was so at odds with the image that foreigners have of Ireland. And I would hope that now we'll see less of that. We see, you know, foreigners with a more realistic view of Ireland, because, you know, I think the referendum result was a big sort of statement about what Ireland is now as against what it was.
A lot of people, as you know, Rory, travelled, you know, some of them from like long distances, like Australia,
yeah,
and here in New York and places, to go home, mm-hmm, and vote. You know, there's a limitation in that in terms of how long you've been outside,
yes,
the country,
yep,
to actually allow you do that, I guess, legally. I mean, at some point, I suppose you could just nip back and not say you were away or whatever.
Well, technically it's 18 months,
yeah,
I believe. But of course, you know, people's polling cards still arrive. I do have one friend. I think he's probably been gone about 2 years, so I think technically he shouldn't. But literally a few days before the referendum, he was on the phone to his mother in Donegal, and he was in Oman,
okay,
in the Middle East, and he said, oh, your polling card arrived.
And got on a flight.
He flew home, went up to Donegal, voted, came back down to Dublin for the party.
Wow. So how do you feel about, because that came up quite a lot, at least here from this end, maybe not so much at home, but do you have strong feelings as to whether there should be a vote for people in the diaspora who are out away longer than 18 months?
Yes, I do. Like, what the actual ins and outs of that would be, because I do realise if you've been gone 30 years and you've completely made your life somewhere else, no, mm-hmm, you've sort of lost the right to, mm-hmm, have a say in a sense. But we're in a position where so many of the people who are living abroad aren't living abroad, you know, because they necessarily want to. They were sort of forced into it for economic reasons or whatever. Or they're just gone to study abroad or to have, you know, a couple of years abroad and expand their horizons, but they fully intend in every way to come home and they still think of Ireland as home. Yes, I think those people should have a say. It's their home too. And so, yeah, I think we need to modernize. I know that we had the fiasco, I'm sure you know, about our e-voting machines, but I don't think that should put us off trying to find some way of giving, you know, Irish people abroad a say in the country that they want to come home to.
I know you've talked a lot, Rory, about the Noble Call speech, which has been, you know, so celebrated, I suppose, in terms of, you know, how well you put across your point of view and everything, how well it was delivered and everything. And I've heard you talk about it in terms of it doesn't sound like it was overly prepared and yet it came off very well. And I think, you know, I sense that you were a little bit modest about it in terms of like the significance of that speech. Do you see that as playing an important role in terms of the referendum, in terms of provoking conversation?
Well, I wouldn't want to overstate it, but I think it started a conversation, which I could never have anticipated. It was all accident in that sense. But it did end up starting a conversation that the country had never had before. It was a real and serious conversation about how Ireland treats its gay citizens and how Ireland wants to treat its gay citizens. And I think it also, I just know from the thousands of emails I got and everything, that it started lots of conversations within families, especially families who have a gay brother, sister, son, daughter, whatever. Because even if you come out to your family, you don't then go home at the weekend and tell your mother about the horrible thing that happened to you. Yeah, that's not what you tell your parents or your brothers and sisters. And I think most families, they can think, you know, that they're fine with their lesbian sister or whatever. So they kind of imagine that everybody is. And so it started conversations within families about what the real experience of being LGBT in Ireland was. And in a weird way, because of the timing of when all of that happened, in some way it kick-started the referendum conversation early, much earlier than had been anticipated. So yes, I do think it played a role in that way. You know, now how big or significant that role is, well, that's...
For me, personally, I think it was very important myself, and actually really enjoy watching it on YouTube over and over. I have to say, it's very inspiring. Within a week or 2 weeks of the passing of the referendum, you went home to Ballinrobe, to your hometown.
Yeah.
It seems so kind of poignant and right that you would do something like that. Can you tell us a little bit about how that happened?
Well, it happened because one of my sisters is super involved in the local, you know, Amdram kind of thing, whatever. And so she was sort of really into it. But also, I have this good friend, Connor Horgan, and he has been photographing panty for over 20 years, I think. And nowadays he's a filmmaker. He used to be, you know, fashion photographer, still photographer, portrait photographer. And he's got into filmmaking, he's made a few films, and about 5 years ago, he asked me, you know, I'd make a documentary with him, and I was actually very reluctant. But I've known him for many years, and he's done me lots of favors over the years, and I trust him and everything. So eventually I said, well, okay. But the idea was it would be a pretty small documentary, and I don't even think Connor was entirely sure what the documentary was going to be about, but he started filming me anyway. And then, of course, when I got into trouble and the Pantygate thing happened and then the Nova Call thing happened, you know, for Connor, as a documentary filmmaker, that was all manna from heaven, you know, and suddenly his documentary was about this other thing. Anyway, so doing the show in Ballinrogue was Connor's idea. He didn't know how the referendum was going to go, so that was sort of up in the air, you know, what the outcome of that would be in the film, whatever. But he thought that doing a show in Ballinrogue regardless would be a lovely thing for his film, and I was super reluctant. And it took a lot of persuasion on his part and my sister's part to get me to agree to do it. Because, of course, I had grown up in this small town, always feeling a little uncomfortable and weird there. I never really felt there was a place for me in Ballinrogue County Mayo. And I've always had this weird relationship with the place. So it was a terrifying prospect for me. But eventually I decided to do it because I thought that regardless, I kind of felt like it was one of those things that you just should do it. And that after I'd done it, I would look back afterwards and think that was a good thing to have done. So I agreed to do it, and then, you know, they organized it, and it was actually really amazing. The whole town got so involved, and it was literally a week after the result. It was the next Saturday, and they had put up a big marquee in a car park in front of the local tire business. They had put rainbow flags up, you know, in the handball alley. There was homemade little rainbow flags on all the front doors on Main Street. There were signs in shop windows, good luck panty, and all this sort of stuff. It was absolutely adorable and lovely. And then I got ready in my parents' house, getting ready at my mother's old dressing table. And then my parents walked me the 150 yards up the Boreen to the marquee, and the whole town was there. And it was surreal and terrifying in some ways, but amazing. It was, the show went really well, and enthusiastically received, and I sort of put a special show together for the town, because there's some things in my show that I ain't going to say in a marquee in Ballinrogue County Mayo, that I just not. And of course also I wanted my mother to enjoy it, so yeah, it was wonderful and amazing. And if you had told me 20 years ago that that would have happened, that there would have been rainbow flags flying in Ballinrogue County Mayo and a drag queen in a tent in the car park, I would just laughed at you. That I just never imagined that could be possible.
So you look back on it now and say you're glad you did it?
Oh, I'm so glad I did it. It was a really wonderful, amazing experience.
Can I ask you, Rory, you're obviously very recognisable as Panty when you walk around or whatever. I know you're probably not walking around generally unless you're doing something. But when you're walking around as Rory O'Neill, either in Dublin or presumably in Ballinrobe, everyone probably knows you anyway. But say when you're walking around in Dublin, are you recognised when you're not Panty? And how do people interact with you when they learn who you are? Or does that happen? Does everyone just know who you are?
It's a mixture. Obviously, I'm much more recognisable as Panty. But out of drag, I'm quite recognisable because, you know, just various things. Especially around the whole Pantygate thing, I sort of had to put Rory to the barricades as well. So that sort of changed that. Because one of the great things about doing drag is
you have the separation.
Yes, you have this total separation and nobody recognizes you.
And has that been a change for you?
Like, yes, that's something I had to get used to. Like, in some ways, I was always very well known in the gay communities. But yes, that sort of changed. Now, it doesn't happen a huge amount because, like I said, Panty is really the well-known face. But it does happen a lot, and it was an adjustment to make and not one that I'm terribly comfortable with. And these days, I try and do everything on costume, because now I don't really need to be Rory in public, if you know what I mean. The other thing is, of course, is I have this voice, which is a blessing and a curse. And the curse part is it's very recognizable. So, yeah, people are sometimes a little unsure until they hear me speaking.
Just to bring us back to New York, how much do you like this city, or is it a city you've spent a lot of time in?
Oh, well, who doesn't like New York, really? It's an amazing city. I've spent a lot of time here, really. I used to do a drag double act in Tokyo with an American drag queen who hung up his frock many years ago, but he then worked for NYU for, well, since the mid-90s till last year. So you worked that out. That's a long time. And he's recently moved to Ann Arbor, Michigan. So I, you know, yes, I regularly come to New York to visit him, and we would go on all sorts of trips and cross-country trips and everything. Yeah, so I spent quite a bit of time in America. Who doesn't love it, really? It's an amazing place, and this is an amazing town. So, yeah, it's never a boring minute if you don't want to have a boring minute. Mm-hmm.
Well, listen, Rory, thank you for coming in to chat to us here on the Luxman Ireland House NYU Radio Hour, and good luck with your final show of this run tonight at the Irish Arts Centre.
We'll be back, hopefully.
Yeah, hopefully, yeah. And I hope you won't be a stranger.
Well, they finally gave me a working visa. for the US. I was coming through immigration in Dublin, you know, the pre-clearance thing, and they pulled me aside, and I thought, oh God, I'm in trouble here, you know, whatever. And they asked me a question, and then he says, the immigration officer says, what kind of performer? And I, you know, stuck my chest out and almost defined that I'm a drag queen. And he goes, oh, you must be very good. And I said, why? He says, because I've never seen a drag queen with an O-1 visa before. But then they wanted to see pictures before they would let me through.
Well, yeah. And you were able to produce them, I'm sure.
Anyway, but now that they've been good enough to give me that, I can come back more easily to work. So
very good, very good. And I hope you won't be a stranger to us here at Luxman Ireland House NYU. You know, as we've mentioned here off-air before we've chatted, what we do here in terms of looking back at Ireland and studying Ireland and constantly questioning our definitions of what we're ascribing to being Irish. You're a very interesting and great example of people who push the boundaries in a way that I think every generation needs it. So thank you so much again, Rory. Honestly,
thanks for having
me.
It's
a big honour for me, and as I said, safe home back to Ireland.
Thank you.
But very nice to be here and be part of this. I've been lecturing at the Yale Summer School. I expect to be there as audience this year, too. And it's always very pleasant. Now, actually, the kinds of things that I'm thinking about now, Yates in America, you know, is not naturally in the interest of the Sligo Yates Society to produce. I mean, they are properly really thinking about Yates, the regional poet. And I want to complement that a little bit with thinking about Yeats as the international figure. And now, these can easily coexist. I mean, give one example and just think about the Nobel speech, which is about the Irish dramatic movement, and it's given in Sweden on an international venue. And so Yeats was always this kind of double threat at the same time. Now, I'm especially interested right now, because I think thinking about Yeats as the international figure helps us think about Yeats a little bit as the cultural ambassador, which is newly of interest because we hear a lot about Irish arts and cultural ambassadorship now. And I think that, you know, Yeats and how he thought about it helps us think about how we think about it and how it happens today. And so Yeats is always very helpful that way. Yeats is always teaching us about ourselves. Now, I want to begin, right, with the Yeatses and the Jameses. And it really begins with a wonderful essay that was by Colm Tobin that was called W.B. Yeats, New Ways to Kill Your Father. And he meant it. He meant it quite literally, too. And what he was doing in the essay was he's comparing John Butler Yeats and Henry James Sr. And the first one, he said, each father, two genius sons. So we're thinking then about William and Jack, and then we're thinking about William and Henry. And then the one area that he used as his third comparison, which is where I really do want to go, is he said this, key words, and these are Tobin's too. John Butler Yeats and Henry James Sr. both employed the Atlantic Ocean as a weapon in their arsenal. And that is a really rich kind of idea, something that Tobin is a very good position to understand, I think, being something of an international figure himself. I mean, what he meant by that, first of all, literally, was he meant that Henry James Sr. tested his family by transporting it eastward to Europe. And that John Butler Yeats tested his family by moving himself westward to America and putting the Atlantic Ocean between himself and his family, too. Different ways to use the Atlantic as a weapon. But that idea of the Atlantic and how it works, I wanted to talk about that, especially about William Butler Yeats now. And he comes to America five times. And I want to especially talk about the final trip, which was over the winter of 1932 to 1933. And Yeats Jr.'s experience was not emigration, like his father, of course. It was for lecture tours. And in that, he had many predecessors and many followers in Ireland coming to New York on the lecture tour. Now, Yeats is different from them, and so I mentioned them by comparison. I mean, first of all, Yeats came to America, and he came again, and he came again. And by that, because it's happening across time, he also came when he was at different points in his work. And further, he came under different conditions. I mean, for example, the first three trips he made was pre-Irish statehood. The fourth trip he made came at the time of war, of Irish war. And then the fifth time he came, the Irish Free State existed. So he's in a very different context when he's going to inform the Americans about Ireland. So the first trip was over 1903 to 1904, in that winter. And over its course, you know, according to Foster, really, Yeats gained what Yeats called his lyric gift in his poetry. And what Foster says, he perfected the version of the Irish National Theatre. And so it's of interest to me that that happened stimulated and primed by being in America. The second voyage was in 1911, and that was much more about the Abbey Theatre, which had arrived before him and had the stormy reception there. Now, the third tour was in winter, spring, 1913-1914, and the primary reason for that was to get financial support for his father. And the second was what Yeats himself by this point was calling his international reputation, and really kind of enjoy it and refurbish it and advance it in some way, too. And Foster was tracing Yeats in these different episodes. And on this trip, the third one, according to Foster, he says, greatness now clearly hung about him. You know, it's the stature that comes from these kinds of experiences, too. It was also interesting that on this trip, he begins to become less the advocate for Ireland than he is the critic of Ireland, and using the perspective from America in order to advance that point of view. The fourth tour was in winter, spring, 1920. So time of Black and Tan War, time of the dark poems, 1919 and the others. His immediate purpose was for raising money for the Tower Tour Ballylee. But you can see how he's using the press and talking about the wars that were happening at home and exactly what he wanted America to understand about them. Now, in all these tours, it's kind of interesting also that Yeats' purpose clearly was to tell America about Ireland. And, you know, at the same time, he had almost no interest in America at all. You know, he was kind of asking for something that he wasn't giving in some way. I say no interest in America, including American literature and other kinds of things, but it is exactly what he was saying in the article, which is American literature still in the Victorian era, which to him was, as you know, very disparaging terms. It was just not modern in the way everything could be. Now, at the same tour, he has a highly publicized interview. Now, the one that I want to talk about most is Yeats' fifth and final voyage to America. So this is October 1932 through January 22nd, 1933. And so when he leaves, it's almost exactly 6 years before his death. And at this trip, he really was on a kind of personal finest kind of a thing. Yeats was in his own late style at this point, too. And so Yeats really does acquire stature at this time. He's genuinely big. And he uses that in America. One of the things that Yeats also paid a lot of attention to in all of these trips was his mode of transportation, because from the beginning to the end, the trajectory is moving from railroad into limousine. And it's on this last trip, and it's in his letters, he never fails to mention that on this trip, his limo was a Lincoln, which really was the destination. I'm also interested in the last trip because this is the one that he did alone, except for American handlers. Then in all the earlier trips, he had been managed by John Quinn, or managed by Lady Gregory, or managed by Georgie Yeats. But in 1931, he came alone. So in 1932, Yeats comes. He's self-proclaimed cultural ambassador. He's going to explain Ireland to America. And at the same time, just as overtly, but just as intentionally, he's also there to influence Ireland from America as a kind of a counter-ambassador. And this is the interesting dimension about how he can work as an international figure. I mean, this is how we find him using the Atlantic Ocean in different ways. Now, the secondary motive to influence Ireland from America was to promote very explicitly, while he was in America, the Irish Academy of Letters and its campaign against Irish censorship. And he was interested in trying to influence Ireland from America on that topic above all. So they put it into a narrative. In 1932, Yeats arrived in New York at 11:15 p.m. It's Wednesday, October 26th. He's aboard the ocean liner Europa. And even before debarking, he gave an interview to the press, which certainly was of interest to Americans, but was really of much more interest to the Irish audience he knew he had. And the first thing Yeats told the Herald Tribune was, "The trouble now with Irish criticism is that it is political rather than literary." Now, he was here to promote the Abbey Theatre, which he did quite well, but he also consistently directed this kind of criticism about being political back to Ireland. And by political, he meant not thought through, not exacting, not really examined in some way, too. And on the third day in New York, he reiterated this again. He was speaking from the stage at the Martin Beck Broadway Theater. And the Abbey was there, and they were doing their repertory. And when Yeats arrived, they broke the repertory, and they did the words upon the window pane for one night. And Yeats attended, and Yeats gave a speech at the end of the play, from the stage. You know, we know so much about Yeats on the stage at the Abbey Theater, but Yeats on the New York stages is an interesting topic, too. You get a sense of the figure, Brooks Atkinson of the New York Times. He said, "When Yeats appeared on the stage to a prosaic New York audience, he comes like a man filled with the fire of heavens. It is remarkably stimulating, in the midst of hackneyed theatricals, to have both a strange play and a passion." So he really welcomed Yeats for introducing something new. Now, when the Abbey came, the words upon the window pane, as I said, was an exception to what they did. The rest of the repertory was the works that were long associated with the Abbey: Playboy of the Western World, Shadow of a Gunman, Kathleen O'Houlihan, which we heard from Lucy this morning, and the only additions were more recent works: Lennox Robinson, George Shields, Paul Vincent Carroll, that really featured the same kind of trademarks of country characters and kitchen settings and verbal comedy. And Yeats's play, of course, is a big departure from all of that. At the same time, Yeats's interest was in a counter-narrative to the Republican vision of modern Ireland, which idealized a rural state. And he found the alternative to that in Swift's 18th century, and he also planned a perfect venue for this in New York. And Yeats keeps emphasizing that the idea of this person who is a Cambridge student is over-enthusiastic, he called it at one time, and yet a measure of truth. And so that by that point, I think he means it's a counter-idea that needs some attention, which is unlikely to happen if Irish criticism is motivated by political bases only. And I think that we can see here, and as I move on, that in America, Yeats was, if anything, more aggressive in promoting this alternative vision than he was when he was home. And after that, Yeats goes on tour. I mean, Words had only the single performance, and after a weekend off, Yeats started his tour. At first, he went to the state of Maine at the Colby College there, and he had a repertory of lectures, and some of it was not new material. He was using the Irish National Theatre, which had first appeared in one version in 1904. He was using a Theatre of the People, which he used again and again on previous American tours, too. But the most frequent one now was a new essay that was called The New Ireland, which is not found among his most frequently republished essays. In the vast publicity for the tour, the announcement advertised that Yeats, and this is the advertisement's language, is tremendously interested in the New Ireland that has come into being since the establishment of the Irish Free State, you know, which would not please the Irish Free State, which thought it was the New Ireland. But you see, now there is another one, too. Now, the text is evidently very much in process, because we have an eyewitness, somebody who was sitting on the stage behind him at Colby College, and he wrote this account of it, too. He says of the Yeats lecture, "Sitting behind him, I could see what the audience could not. Huge sheets of paper, twice the size of this sheet," he was writing on 8.5 by 11, "spread out in the big reading desk and covered with letters fully an inch high." So Yeats is working on this very handwritten, block print kind of text that he can keep changing as he goes, and each time he does it, he adds more to it. It's interesting that all of these accounts, really, they report always on the style on the oratory and almost never on the content at all, you know, which is what he's trying to reach them on that, which is not happening. But on this tour, Yeats presented this essay, The New Ireland, much more than the other ones. After Colby, he used it at Ann Arbor, he used it in Montreal, and then he hit the campuses, Dartmouth, Columbia, Bryn Mawr, Wellesley, always with this essay above others. Now, in a different kind of an interview than the ones I was talking about in 1932, he began to sort of sharpen this image in the press. This interview is at the same time as the same month as the Colby presentation. And he's really beginning to talk much more about the wider culture in our Irish life. And that now is becoming his primary message rather than the secondary one. And so in this interview, he said, there were two Irelands, one Protestant, one Catholic, and I began to plot and scheme how I might seal with the right image the soft wax before it began to harden. I thought that the two opposing forces might be brought together if a national literature could be developed which would make Ireland beautiful in memory and yet be freed from provincialism by an exacting criticism. So you can see the interview blurb coming through as he sharpens this. And at this point, he really had something to talk about in Ireland, because the idea of hardening at this point, he's talking about the De Valera agenda, he's talking about topical events. At this point, the cattle embargo is a major thing. He's talking about the future of economic autonomy, which is being discussed in Ireland. And he wants to use what he calls here exacting criticism and distinguish that from nationalist mythology and political loyalties, which he felt were ruling in Dublin. And so in New York, Yeats is announcing a minority view. Now, his message in America was not only heard by admirers and acolytes. That's not the reason he was here. He had his American opponents also. 1 month after, say, the Colby visit in December 32, there was an attack on the Irish Academy published by Father Francis Talbot, S.J. He's a very prominent historian. He is publishing frequently in the Jesuit magazine called America, which still exists. And very soon after this, he will become the editor of this journal, of this magazine, too. And he was not an admirer of Yeats. He wrote this: an Irish Academy of Literature has been founded. It has been germinated in the dark places of the brain of William Butler Yeats for a number of years. You know, and then it goes on in this vein. The invective is great. I mean, things people don't really say anymore, too. But at the same time, you know, we can say this is right. I mean, it had been growing in Yeats's mind since the Irish Censorship of Publications Act in 1929. And so that's a few years. And this is the primary reason for the creation of the Academy, to oppose censorship in Ireland. And of course, censorship was not unique to Ireland. All of us know that, you know, in the UK, North American copyright world, we have the cases of James Joyce and D.H. Lawrence and many others. But I think that Yeats, you know, focusing here was justified in thinking that the Censorship Act in Ireland was particularly repressive and really did harm the careers of a lot of young writers, too. Now, and what Yeats was talking about in America, he also had opponents in Ireland as well. Now, while for Father Talbot in America, he wrote his piece and claimed that the Irish readers need to be protected by the Censorship Act from debauching and pornographic periodicals and books. But he also then could cite a fellow Jesuit in Dublin, Father P.J. Gannon, S.J., who was also going to become an influential editor, in this case of the journal Studies, in Ireland. And Gannon said that the idea of an academy was unwelcomed and unauthorized. Now, I followed Yeats through New York through January 33, and I take just enough time to take one brief digression until we see him off and return to Ireland, too. Because it's a good way to illustrate how the Atlantic can be used. Now, Yeats' tour was really helped and partly funded by Patrick McCartan, who is really an interesting story in this kind of relations of things. So McCartan's born in Tyrone, became a Republican in around 1916, did his jail time because of 16. Later he toured with De Valera in America and wrote a very famous book about it, that very best-selling book, With De Valera in America. And after that, he immigrated to Philadelphia, became very well-established as a wealthy physician-politician, and once was a candidate for an independent, a third-party ballot for the presidency of the United States. I think this is especially interesting here in Ireland House, because if you think about Patrick McCartney, I've written a lot about another kind of a person, Republican, then later in New York, James Campbell. In addition to that, in the NYU context, we of course have Ernie O'Malley. And so I'm very interested, really, in how we get these three different kind of Republican theaters come to America with completely different narratives about what happened to them. It's another story. But now, seeing that Yeats and the Academy draw the wrath of the Jesuits in New York and Dublin, McCartney in 1934 sent Yeats a copy of a Eugene O'Neill play called Days Without End. The play had been opened in New York in January, but what McCartney was telling Yeats was that a production by the Abbey would be a complete answer to the Jesuits without writing or saying a word in reply. Now, the play is about a very tortured figure who's very worried about his commitment to Catholic faith. And what McCartney is telling Yeats is, just put it on and, you know, a Catholic play will placate the government. And now the play actually had been panned in New York. It was not at all successful, and in fact led to the decline in O'Neill that would not be really changed until we get into the later stage of early release of Long Day's Journey Into Night and other things that really created the interest in O'Neill too. But the play that failed in New York really did well in Dublin. Yeats wrote back to McCartney, I got a telegram from my wife with these words, great success, magnificent acting, good production, every seat is taken every night. And so the Catholic, or what Yeats said in this letter actually was that the success of this perfectly orthodox play has come at the right moment for us, meaning the Abbey, as we were having some trouble with the government, the echoes of which may have reached you. And apparently just producing this play with a Catholic content then eased the relations with government for a brief time anyway. So then getting ready to leave, back in New York in 1933, Yeats spent New Year's week going to Boston, traveling for seances, but he was also building a final fundraiser for the Academy that would be funded by McCartney. And so with some fanfare, he announced that he was going to delay his sailing from New York, and there would be a benefit performance of his play, King Sophocles, on January 15th. This had not been planned by the Abbey. They had the actors who had done it in Dublin, but they didn't have the costumes, and so it was thrown together. Now, the play has been of interest to Yeats since at least 1912, and the play also has kind of an interesting history of censorship in Britain. But Yeats was very interested in putting it on in New York and giving it this particular lens of the act of censorship in Ireland. Now, what he did to prepare the way for that was to create an essay in the press that was featured in the New York Times called Plain Man's Oedipus. And the essay opened with recollection of prohibition of the play in Britain, but also it presents it as, which is rather unusual, that the lesson of Oedipus being about clear thinking, exacting examination, and understanding things rather than following from platitudes. And in New York, this was very successful, and it performed what he was talking about in coming to understand the reality of things. For Brooks Atkinson, in the Times, the effect was new and very different. Atkinson wrote of this, in its reserve and deliberation, it represents the pole furthest removed from magnetic folk opera, like a folk drama, like everything else the Abbey does. Now, while for the words of the window pane, Yeats gave a speech after the performance, when we come to this final play performance at the end of his trip, now he does pre-performance talk. He talks on the stage before anybody has seen anything, and so he can put exactly the edge on it that he wants. Now, after that night of Oedipus, Yeats celebrated the end of his fifth and last tour of America at a dinner party at the Waldorf, which was arranged by Patrick McCartan. The guests included John McCormack, composer Hamilton Hardy, the Irish luminaries were there. And at this, McCartan could announce that Yeats was departing both with an American endorsement and endowment for the Academy. And he also managed to use this to fund a prize for individual writers. Oliver Gogarty also was at the dinner, and he also spoke, and he was the opening of his tour, but his tour was for himself, whereas Yeats's tour was for all of these other kinds of causes. And what happened, because of the postponement, Yeats waited, and he did passage aboard the Bremen in January 22nd, and his final interview, again, on deck, you know, the last word before the gangplank goes up, gave final thoughts of America, what he knew would be his final visit, certainly. And he said that America as a country was too exciting, was his final word as he left. So, in conclusion, I mean, I am very interested in thinking about the idea of what Yeats is doing here, announcing a new cultural bond, because now we hear that every March also, too, that there's going to be a new cultural bond that will be different than all the other ones that have happened before. Now, I also think it's very interesting that in all of this, Yeats really does remain an exemplar of thinking about or thinking through cultural bonds and using them as an aggressive campaign for cultural advancement. And that does not always happen everywhere. If you look at some recent examples, such as the Irish government with cultural Ireland, you know, the ambition seems much more rooted in the present more than anything else. You know, to brand Irish arts for an immediate present need rather than the longer term one that Yeats was working for. And so the kind of debate Yeats urged on Ireland from New York is, you know, continues to be timely, particularly as we just hardly began this morning to begin to think about the decade of commemorations and the presence of both sides of the Atlantic as that is emerging in that discussion too. And also, it's a good reminder, you know, having taken the idea from Tolbien, but how adept Yeats was at using the Atlantic as a weapon in different ways. And also, I think, introducing the idea of Yeats, you know, of course, the regional and national poet on the 150th anniversary of his birth, but also in interesting ways, a very major kind of international cultural figure at the same time. Thank you.
We're coming towards the end of the program. I'm Dr. Miriam Nighan, and I want to thank you for listening to the Glucksman Ireland House NYU Radio Hour. Our theme music today is The Opening Set by The Gloaming, released by Brassland and Real World Records. I'll be back again next Saturday, same time, on WNYE 91.5 FM and on HD Radio in the Tri-State area, worldwide on nyuirish.net/radiohour, and at irishradio.com. In the meantime, if you'd like to get in touch with me or my co-producer, Jamie Sweeney, our email address is ireland.house@nyu.edu. If you'd like to hear this program again, please go to nyuirish.net/radiohour or to irishradio.com. Stay tuned for the Adrian Flanelly Show up next on WVNJ 1160 AM. And for those of you listening to irishradio.com, do stay with us until noon. Have a lovely weekend, folks. Thanks for tuning in. Slán agus beannacht.